Well, we're still studying in the fifth chapter of Deuteronomy tonight. Last time we'd gotten to about the 16th verse, and we're dealing here primarily with the Ten Commandments. And we probably cannot place enough emphasis on the Ten Commandments. This truly is the law of Moses. However, any time God gives a law, usually there are so many principles that are so basic until these principles would be good any time. Now, there may be some specific items of the law that wouldn't apply to one dispensation or another, but the basic principles usually apply. So when we're talking about principles, we're talking about an ageless group of laws here. When we're talking about some of the specific items in these laws, then there are some things that might not apply to one group or one dispensation as well as it would to another dispensation. But I'd like to just kind of review some things about the Ten Commandments. We're going to be talking about them quite a bit tonight and also maybe even next time. Beginning in the first part of the fifth chapter, as he talks about these, he says, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and judgments which I speak in your ears this day, that you may learn them and keep and do them." Now, that's true of all of God's statutes and judgments. They're to be learned, they're to be kept, and they're to be done. Not just something to know about or get a little bit of an acquaintance with and go on to something else. These are to become a part of us, these principles of God. Then he goes on in the second verse and says, "The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb." Another thing I want to mention about the Ten Commandments is that it was actually a covenant. Now, this covenant was made with the children of Israel as they stood at the foot of Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb. It applied to Israel. It applied to the descendants of Israel. But as we will study later, we'll see that that same covenant does not apply to the New Testament age today as it did then. We've been given a new covenant of which Jesus Christ is the mediator. And we'll study a little bit more about that before we get out of this area of the Ten Commandments. He says, "The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us who are all of us here alive this day." And there he's talking about the patriarchs, Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and the fathers of the 12 tribes. He's not talking about the fathers of these people who stood right here listening to him, because he did make this covenant with them, of course. Some 38 to 40 years before this, he made this covenant. But he's talking about this was not made with the patriarchs. They lived under the patriarchal dispensation, and they had there the covenant of circumcision. And it seems that as God graduates from the patriarchal age, in which he dealt with just the heads of families, to the time now when he has a nation, and he gives them this covenant, this law of Moses, then on up until the time that we actually have the law of faith, the Christian age, that he gets a higher law each time that requires more spiritual activity. Today in the spiritual age, we have fewer things to look and see and touch than they had then. We do not have an actual temple that we can build and touch and see and go inside of. That's a physical temporal structure. Nor do we have an Ark of the Covenant as they had. Nor do we have all of the items like the golden censer, nor the golden candlestick, nor the laver, nor the sacrifices that they had of animals. And on and on. We do not have those things. Although we do have some things. About the nearest temporal thing we do have today would be the Lord's Supper, the communion, where we have bread and fruit of the vine that represents the body of the Savior. But today it's a spiritual temple, and the church is a spiritual organization. The boundaries of the church have no earthly boundaries. It extends all over the whole face of the globe, and on and on. What I'm trying to say is God graduates into more of a spiritual area as time goes on. So this is a higher covenant in many ways than the covenant of circumcision was. It has many, many more details than the covenant of circumcision had. And so we're not just dealing here now with the law to the patriarchs. We have another covenant that was given with Moses as the mediator. And it's a covenant that wasn't given with our fathers, he said, but given with us, all of us here this day. Many of the principles given here had been practiced and given to the patriarchs, but it's not identical. And so it is when we get into the New Testament, we'll see that this covenant also is not identical to the one that we have today. The covenant we have today wasn't given by Moses. It was given by Christ. Another thing we'd like to point out here is, and we'll learn this later, is that this law of Moses was a temporary thing. It was only given to hold the people under a schoolmaster until faith should come. And after faith should come, then they were no longer under the schoolmaster. And we'll talk about that before we finish with this chapter. The Lord spoke this face to face while he was in the presence of the burning mountain, and they were standing near enough to it to be able to see it and experience all of the sounds and feelings that came forth from the mountain. And then as he gave the commandments, the first one was, "I shall have none of the gods before me." The idea of the one God was paramount here. The second one was, "I shall not make thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that's in heaven above or that's in earth beneath or it's in the waters beneath the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them nor serve them." They were not to have idolatry. This tells how they were to worship God by telling them how they were not to worship God. They were not to worship God like the other nations round about them worship their gods. That does make a difference with God how he's worshipped. He will not let us worship him just any way that we please and it be well pleasing to him. He specifies how he is to be worshipped, and he also here specifies how he is not to be worshipped. And when we leave out all of these paganistic and heathenistic ways, then the only thing we have left, in most cases, is what God has given. Because this rules out most of the way that the rest of the world would try to worship God today. Even those that are in the digressive denominations, they use these things that are condemned here in this second command. I'd like to point out that the Catholic Church, for instance, a group that does believe they should be keeping these Ten Commandments today, the Catholic Church, in order to allow them to use all of their images and their likenesses and the idolatrous forms that they have and that they bow down to and that they serve, they've left the Second Commandment out and combined it in with the First. And then in order to make the number complete, they divided the Tenth Commandment into two commandments to make a Ten Commandments. So the literature that they give to their members that they want them to read does not include this Second Commandment as it's given here. Now that to me is very significant. I mean, they either should keep this or they should not keep it. And if they should keep it as they claim, then they should keep it as it is written here. And this definitely condemns idolatry in all forms or fashions or any mimicking of idolatry. This would include a lot of things now, not only graven images, but also pictures, any likeness, it says, of anything, whether it's a human or whether it's an animal or whether it's a celestial body, it doesn't matter. It would also include such things as the steeples that would be put on outside of a building, or a belfry, or a cross, anything that is symbolic of anything religious that is made and looked to as having some kind of a symbolism, this command would condemn that. And we'll see how that this also applies in the New Testament also. I'm not going to give a New Testament comparison right now. We're going to go through the Ten Commandments and then go back and give a New Testament comparison later. And he says further about this idolatry. He says, "For I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God." This is one of the reasons he didn't want to do this. He didn't want to be replaced by any other God. He wanted to be their God, the only God they had. And idolatry, of course, would not allow him to be the only God. Idolatry made room for some other God to come in. Even though it wasn't a true living God, still God does not want to share with anything like that. Then he says, "Visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children, under the third and fourth generation of them that hate me." Now, to visit the iniquity of the fathers means that he recognizes the sins of the fathers. He recognizes the sins of the fathers. And he because he recognizes those sins, then he is going to mete out appropriate punishment. But he recognizes the sins of the fathers, or he visits the iniquity of the father upon the children. This would teach us that the children have to suffer the consequences then of the sins of the fathers. And he goes on and says, unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me. Some of the scholars have interpreted this to mean that God may not start to punish idolatry until it has existed for 3 to 4 generations. And then the sins of the fathers are visited upon the children in those third and fourth generations. And this does seem to have some basis to it, because as we study the history of the Israelite people, we see how that idolatry was practiced many times, and it wasn't punished immediately, but the punishment came later on down the line. But we also see that those who received the punishment were still guilty of the same practices that the fathers had. And this teaches us a great lesson, and that is that many of the sins that we may be guilty of, we may be guilty simply because we have been taught them and handed them down to us by our forefathers. And so consequently, we may receive the punishment for sins that our forefathers did because we have continued to practice those things simply because we have followed their tradition. And many of the things that are done wrong today are done wrong because they have been handed down as tradition. They didn't come from the Bible, they didn't come from God, but they did come from tradition. And so this idea of tradition having as much strength and as much power as the Word of God has is a very false and erroneous idea. However, many of the so-called religionists today staunchly stand for the fact that tradition has as much power and as much meaning and influence as the Word of God has. And that just is not true, and it never has been true. These traditions are not to be kept at all. We're to follow after the Word of God and let it be our first and our last authority. So that's an interesting statement there about visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation. Sometimes we wonder why this brought about so much of a punishment, but if we knew the total picture, we might see that it's being punished because God's put up with it for four generations in this one family, and it's worn his patience thin now, and so he has to do some drastic thing about it. I don't have the total explanation for that, but it's an interesting statement. And showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. So he is equally a merciful God, just as surely as he is a God that's willing to visit iniquity. Verse 11, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Now, this, of course, as we talked last time, is about using the name of God in a way that is less than reverential, a way that is less than total respect and meaningful. All frivolous and light uses of God's name would violate this principle and this command. Such a phrase as, "Oh, my heavenly days," is a violation of this. Such a phrase as using the word mercy in a non-meaningful way. My goodness, all the minced words that have reference to God or that would mean his name, except the word's been changed just a little bit. All of this is taking his name in vain. Not to mention the actual out-and-out, what's regarded as hard swearing. That's taking his name in vain, too. Also, some have even suggested that to wear the name of a Christian and not to live up to those principles, to make the claim of being a Christian and yet not following the principles of Christianity, is a way of taking his name in vain. You've taken it, you wear it, you claim to have it, but it has no meaning because you're not living up to those principles of Christianity. Also, it's been suggested that to even teach a false doctrine and claim that this comes from God and this is the thing God would have us to do, that also could be a taking of his name in vain. So you see what a broad, all-sweeping command this is. And there are many, many people who claim and seem to live staunch Christian lives, but they violate this principle by their tongue by using God's name lightly or the things of God in a light, frivolous, meaningless way. And God doesn't want that. We should be very careful about how we speak and be sure that what we say has meaning, that it gives the appropriate thought about God and the things of God, and that it's not used in some meaningless way just to convey more emphasis to another thought. If we were to say, I call God to record that what I say is true, we should really mean that I am doing this. I'm truly calling God to act as a witness to what I say. And not just say some statement like God knows and not even really knowing and meaning what we say. He says, regarding that, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. Now, God has promised he's not going to overlook that mistake. Then the fourth command is, keep the Sabbath day to sanctify it as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee. And that is a rather difficult command to give the total explanation of. This Sabbath day was the seventh day, and there are many interesting things about this. He says, 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. The work was to be done in 6 days. And the way it's worded here, 6 days were to be used for work. It wasn't just a matter of working 2 or 3 days and then not doing any work for a while and then finally taking off the seventh day. He said, work 6 days. 6 days do all your work. And then on the seventh, you were not to do any work. You were not to have your son, your daughter, your manservant, your maidservant, your ox, your ass, your any cattle, any stranger within thy gates, that the manservant and the maidservant may rest as well as thou. No work was to be done. You were not to require it to be done by anybody that you had any connection with. Let's talk just a little bit about this Sabbath. There are many people who hold that we should keep the Sabbath day holy today. We're going to show later that this covenant really isn't meant for us to keep, and we only keep those principles and laws in it that are given to us as Christians. But in talking about the keeping of the Sabbath day, there are several ramifications that I'd like to elaborate upon. In Exodus 20, where he gives this same command, he words it a little bit differently. Exodus 20 and 11. He says, for in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now some people read that and they say, well, that means then that the Lord wanted them to keep this day holy because it was the day that he had blessed and hallowed, and so they're keeping it. He gave it to them to keep it because he blessed it and hallowed it. And then they take that one step further and say, then that means that that's a universal law for all mankind to keep from the beginning of creation on through to the end, because it started when he created the earth. But let's stop and look and see just what did happen now. Back in Genesis, the second chapter, he talks about that. Genesis 2, beginning with the second verse. And on the seventh day, God ended his work which he had made, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all his work which God created and made. Now the question is raised, Moses wrote this, and Moses lived many, many years after this happened. He probably wrote this while he was in Horeb that 40 years in that wilderness. And so many people think that Moses is telling about God blessing and hallowing the seventh day, but that it doesn't necessarily mean that he blessed it and hallowed it at the time that he rested on it. but he could have waited until he gave it to the children of Israel to have blessed it and hallowed it. Now, this is just a question. It doesn't really matter a whole lot about whether it's this way or not, but it's a thought that the blessing and hallowing of the day might not have occurred until he gave it to the children of Israel after they left the land of Egypt. So it may be that God didn't bless and hallow the day at the time he rested on it, but he could have waited 2,500 years later when he gave it to the children of Israel. But what we're really talking about is two things. One thing is that he did rest on this day, and that he did bless and hallow it. But another thing is, why did he have them to keep a day? Why did he have the children of Israel keep a day? Not because he rested on the day. He had them to keep the day because it was a commemoration between him and them that he'd brought them out of the land of Egypt. As he says in our chapter tonight, the 15th verse, "And remember that thou wast a servant in the land of Egypt, and that the Lord thy God brought thee out thence with a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord thy God commanded thee to keep the Sabbath day." Why did he command them to keep it? Because he brought them out of the land of Egypt. Now, why did he choose the seventh day? Because it was the same day he rested on, and he hallowed that day. So he wanted them to keep a day, to keep a day to commemorate their being brought out of the land of Egypt. Which day was he going to choose? He chose the seventh day because that's the day he rested on, an appropriate day to choose. And so we have to keep in mind then that he gave it to them to keep because they were brought out of Egypt. Not because he rested on it, but because they were brought out of Egypt. But he chose that day as the day because that's the one he rested on. And he hallowed it and sanctified it. It might have been hallowed at the time he gave it to them. It might have been hallowed back at the beginning. But from the way the Bible is written, it's hard for us to say for sure. Now, let's look at some other things about this day. He words this in Exodus 20. In Ezekiel 20, verse 10. "Wherefore I caused them to go forth out of the land of Egypt, and brought them into the wilderness, and I gave them my statutes, and showed them my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. Moreover, I gave them my Sabbaths, to be a sign between me and them, that they might know that I am the Lord that sanctify them." So Ezekiel says, "I gave them my Sabbaths," as though this was a rather new and unique thing for man to be doing, is to be having the Sabbath given him to keep as a holy day. So we see then that it wasn't given to any other nation. It was only given to those brought out of the land of Egypt, which that wouldn't apply to us. But as we look further at this Sabbath, if we are to keep it, then we are to keep it the way it's supposed to be kept. First of all, we notice that it began at sundown on Friday night and ended sundown on Saturday night. A 24-hour period there. Roughly 24-hour period. But we find that in some parts of the world, for example, in Alaska, in the summertime, there are some areas where the sun never sets. In Fairbanks, Alaska, I'm told that the sun is up 24 hours a day. So when would the Sabbath day begin and end? You couldn't use the Old Testament rule of sundown to sundown because it wouldn't apply there. It would apply where Israel was, but it wouldn't apply in a place where the church is today in Alaska. Now, God apparently didn't intend for people in Alaska to keep this day. It was intended for the Israelites to keep it in that section of the world where they lived. Again, in Exodus 16:23, he teaches that they were not to boil or to bake anything on that day. No boiling or baking. Really, there wasn't to be any cooking done. Again, we learn that there were to be no fires built. Here again, if you lived in an Arctic or a cold climate, it'd be rather difficult to get along and have no fires built on that 24-hour period. No fires at all. That would be no cooking, no keeping warm, no fires of any kind. And we might even, as we think of this room with the electric lights being full of fires now, you'd have to stop all of those things. It'd be rather difficult to drive an automobile because as you fire up the engine, you've got a fire going there. You can see all the things that the Israelites would not have had difficulty with that we today would have difficulties with. Not that it'd be impossible to do, but what I'm saying is nobody who claims to keep this and who tries to bind this really keeps it. And then there was a Sabbath to be kept every seventh year. That also is a Sabbath to be kept. And then every 50th year, the year of Jubilee, was another sabbatical period. And they all applied together with this. We also learned that on that day, two male lambs, a year old, were to be offered, according to Numbers 28, verse 9. Who offers two male lambs today on that day? Again, we learned that a meal offering and a drink offering were to be given in Numbers 28 and 9. We also learned in Numbers 15:32-36 that you were not to pick up sticks on that day. And the example of a man who did pick up sticks on that day was given there to show that he was stoned to death. He also says in Exodus 35:2, the seventh day there shall be unto you a holy day, a Sabbath of solemn rest unto Jehovah. Whosoever doeth any work therein shall be put to death. Now, any work therein shall be put to death. Do we see anybody putting people to death because they violate this, or do they hold the principle that somebody should be put to death if they violate this, if they do any work? Now, any work. He goes on and elaborates on that in Exodus 20 and 10. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, nor thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that's within thy gates. Of course, we read that in our chapter tonight. The death penalty was to be given for anybody who profaned the Sabbath. What I'm trying to say is that nobody who claims to keep this really keeps it. It's just as wrong to try to bind the Sabbath and then not keep it according to the way it was supposed to be kept as it is to try to bind the Ten Commandments and then take that second command out and go ahead and practice idolatry like some do. If you're going to keep it, you have to keep it all the way that it is supposed to be kept if you're going to bind it as the covenant was bound. Well, as we go on through these commands, the fifth one is, honor thy father and thy mother, as the Lord thy God has commanded thee, that thy days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Now, this command is quoted again in Ephesians 6 and 2. It's definitely alluded to there as being one that's still in effect, still binding. We're told to honor our parents, to obey them, for it's right. He talks about it being the first command with promise, and that it may go well with thee. And you can see how that one of the basic cornerstones of the family is for the father and the mother to be honored. This is a basic necessity for any society to be successful. The father and the mother have to be honored. Now, it's not just a matter of showing love, but it's a matter of going beyond just love, but giving them honor. There are other people you can love without having to give the same honor that you do to your parents. The parents are, for a certain period in our lives, the parents are in the place of God. We don't know anything, any other authority greater than the parents. We have no way of reaching any other authority than the parents. So the parents are all of it to us for a certain period of our lives. And if we cannot learn to show honor to our parents, then we're not going to show honor to any other authority, which would be God and which would be the laws of the land. So this is the reason why that it will go well with you if you learn to honor your parents. This is the way that your days may be long upon the earth if you honor your parents, because it's to violate this, then is setting a whole set of circumstances against you that will go against you for the rest of your life. This is how people get off on so-called the wrong track. And they lead a life of crime, or they lead a life that's just a little bit sub below the level of a good citizen, or the way that the law would have them to do. And not to mention the fact that they get off on the wrong track and lead a life that is contrary to what God wants. When we're leading a life contrary to God, then we're doing things that are going to go against us physically and temporally, as well as things that are definitely going to go against us in the final judgment day. So this is the beginning. This is how to get on the right track. It's honor the parents. Now, we may find that our parents are wrong in some things, but we still have learned this vital principle of being able to honor, being able to respect, to obey, to submit, and to recognize that there is a power greater than us, and that our whims and our desires are not the ultimate ends in our life. We learn that basic lesson by honoring the parents. And it's a necessary lesson. People who have not learned how to honor their parents don't know how to honor anybody else. They cannot honor anybody else. We're taught the basic lesson about love. If you can't love God, you can't love your brother. And vice versa. If you can't love your brother, you can't love God. So people who are not obeying God, I have a high degree of skepticism in their ability to do me right at all times, because they don't have the ability to do right. They do not know how to do right, because they do not know how to do God right. He says here, to do this, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee, that thy days may be prolonged, and that it may go well with thee in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. The next command in verse 17, the sixth command, thou shalt not kill. Now we know that this is one that applies to the New Testament. It's reiterated in several places. In 1 Peter 4:15, he says not to suffer as a murderer. That is, do not commit this crime so that you will be made to suffer because of it. We're told not to kill in James. We're told about the law of love, which we're going to talk about later, which would definitely preclude and exclude killing. And Jesus, as he talks about this, he says not to even be angry with your brother without a cause. It's a much broader command than just not taking a life. And God felt so strongly about it at the time this was given that even if a person kills somebody accidentally, he then had to flee to a city of refuge or he'd be stoned to death. Even if he was tried and found to be innocent, he still had to stay in the city of refuge till the high priest died, or he would be stoned to death. Now, that's how strongly God felt about killing. Thou shalt not kill. Well, people say, just blatantly say, well, it doesn't include such acts as going to war and such acts as capital punishment. The only place that you'd be permitted to kill would be where God had made arrangements for you to do so. He has made none for us to kill in the New Testament. And at the time he made these arrangements, in the Old Testament even, it's whenever he specifically directed and demanded that this be done. And then he didn't give anybody a choice. You may kill or you may not kill. He demanded that it be done. You didn't have a choice in it. It wasn't because you were angry. It wasn't because you were overwrought with emotion. You were carrying out coolly and calculatedly a command of God. When you went into war, certain battles they engaged in, God wouldn't let them permit them to leave anybody alive. They killed everybody. When they stoned somebody to death for committing a certain crime, he wouldn't permit them to soften their heart and let them go ahead and live. When this was given, he intended that this be followed, thou shalt not kill. And then when you did kill, and it was because God had given you a divine and positive command to do so, it wasn't really you doing it. It was you carrying out God's desire for you to do it. And there's no room made for that in the New Testament today. We do not have any permission today to kill. Neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor. Now this is the ninth command. We left one out, the seventh command. Let's go back to the seventh command. Verse 18. neither shalt thou commit adultery. Now, adultery, in its true, strict sense, was for a person that's married to commit an illicit sexual act that violates the marriage. But it also has a broader sense that would include fornication, in that when you commit an illicit sexual act, you have already violated the property that will belong to a future spouse. So that really would become, even then, an act of adultery, although you don't have a marriage at that time. When the marriage does come, you have violated that sacred trust. And this is taught against throughout the Bible. Adulterers were to be stoned to death in the Old Testament. As we get into Deuteronomy 24, we're going to talk about the putting away of giving the bill of divorcement, I'm sorry. And there we'll talk about the reasons for that. Jesus said that whenever he was talking about this, that it included even to look upon a woman to lust after her. He said, you've already committed adultery with her in your own heart. So this was a very all-sweeping command. The New Testament speaks about having eyes full of adultery and it condemns it. It condemns adulterers and fornicators in the New Testament. The eighth command, neither shalt thou steal. This, of course, is a basic rule, not to steal. It's taught in the New Testament several times, specifically enumerated not to steal. Taking things that are not ours is strictly forbidden. The ninth commandment, neither shalt thou bear false witness against thy neighbor. This would be to tell the neighbor a lie. It would be to say things about the neighbor that were not true, false, slanderous, misleading statements. And it would also be to testify something about the neighbor that would be false witness, for example, in a court of law, to testify or to state that this person was guilty of a certain thing, you saw them do it, when really and truly you didn't. And this is plainly taught also in the New Testament. It says, lie not one to another, or we're not to do this. Now, the tenth commandment, neither shalt thou desire thy neighbor's wife, neither shalt thou covet thy neighbor's house, his field, or his manservant, or his maidservant, his ox, or his ass, or anything that is thy neighbor's. And this, of course, is the command against coveting. We're not to covet. The fact that we don't actually do something, but we just harbor the thoughts and the secret desire and the aching to be able to do it, would violate this command. And when we look at it from that standpoint, it's not just a command of doing things. This is a command that includes our thoughts. It includes our desires. Coveting. It's not to covet, not to desire it. And this is such a common feeling that people have. A person has something that's nice, they say, oh, I wished I had that. Oh, how I'd like to have that. People may say, even in a joking way, how they'd like to take this certain item and leave him something else that'd be a lot lesser desirable. We're not to get our mind thinking in those type of thoughts, according to this command, and according to the principle laid down here. That type of thinking is designed to cause us then to take one more step and maybe actually do the act of taking it. Or maybe prejudice our feeling about that person because of what he or she may possess. God has given those things to that person. They're not ours. And the things that he's given us then, that's what we're to be content with. We're told that godliness with contentment is great gain. And this should be our thought about it. Now, as we stop and look at these Ten Commandments here, they're divided into two portions. The first four have to do with God and the duty to God. The second six have to do with our duty to man, our duty to man. And we find that Jesus made a statement in Matthew 22, verses 36 through 40. Master, which is the great commandment in the law? Jesus said unto him, Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like unto it, Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. So you can see how the first commandment then, to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, mind, and spirit, that's the first four commands. The second great command, which is like unto it, love thy neighbor as thyself, that's the second six commands. It has to do with honoring the parents, not committing adultery, not stealing, not lying, not coveting, and not committing murder. So that's a summation of the Ten Commandments, you might say, of the Decalogue. Jesus said, on these two commands hang all the law and the prophets. We're talking about the spirit of the law, what really the law is including. It's including not violating anything that belongs to God and not violating anything that belongs to man. That's what it includes. Well, again, we look in Romans 13 and see a very similar statement there, talking about the New Testament now. He says, owe no man anything, verse 8, but to love one another. For he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. Now, talking about keeping the law, he that loveth another hath fulfilled the law. For this thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not bear false witness, thou shalt not covet. And if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, namely, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Love worketh no ill to his neighbor, therefore love is the fulfilling of the law. Now, that's another way of saying this. If you want to keep this law, then you have love, because love is the fulfilling of the law. Love means you're not going to work any ill to God, you're not going to work any ill to your neighbor. And so when we look at the New Testament principle here that's applied, if we're going to keep this according to the New Testament, then what he requires here is to keep the principle of love. And he says, this is the fulfilling of the law. And he says, if there be any other commandment, it is briefly comprehended in this saying, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. A very fitting way for it to be put, but it's written in the New Testament as New Testament law for us, and this is our way then to look on this. So this law requires love. And yet, we find that God requires love of us, and as we follow the law of love, then we're going to be following all these principles in this Decalogue that apply to us. Now, if we love God, for example, we're not going to have idolatry, have any other God before Him, take His name in vain. We're not going to do that if we love God. And we also, by the same token, are not going to be guilty of adultery, or murder, or lying, or stealing, or coveting, or dishonoring our parents if we love our neighbor. So the principle of love then...